Two-thirds of all cancer cases are linked to preventable environmental causes. That's according to a study published by the National Library of Medicine. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us. We're talking about the new book. It's titled A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. It's about the people fighting to stop cancer before it begins. And joining us today is Christina Marusek. She is an author and journalist. She writes for Environmental Health News, covering environmental health and justice. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with her. When it comes to fighting cancer, what are your priorities? Which chemicals worry you the most? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Christina Marusek, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you certainly opened my eyes, and I shuddered a bit as I was reading some of the things, although it's overall a positive book in some ways, but you tell some great stories. In the beginning, you write that there were 50 years that we are 50 years into the battle against cancer, but we're losing it. What makes you say that?
We're much better than we used to be at treating cancer. We've put a lot of money and funding and time and energy into developing new treatments and searching for cures, but we're also getting a lot more cancer than we used to. So today, one in every three Americans can expect to get a cancer diagnosis at some point in our lifetime. So most of us will either be affected or have a loved one affected by cancer at some point. And just because we're better at treatments doesn't mean we've solved the problem of cancer. So more than 1,600 Americans still die from cancer every day. And then treatment is really difficult and really unpleasant. So therapies like chemo can have side effects that last for a lifetime, and survivors live with the fear that their disease might come back and have to go in, you know, regularly for follow-up scans and experience that anxiety every time they do. So again, we're 50 years in, but we're kind of stunted on our progress on cancer and certainly on cancer prevention. And I think the main reason we're failing to prevent cancer is that we're not funding prevention. So only 7 to 9% of global cancer funds go toward prevention right now.
So the other 90% or so goes to, once you have it, cancer, then how to deal with it. Well, I thought it's an interesting story about how you came to write this book. Maybe you could talk about that and why you did it.
Yeah, my younger sister was diagnosed with thyroid cancer when she was 25 years old, which is very young for a cancer diagnosis. And thyroid cancer tends to run in families, but no one else in our family had ever had it, and no one has had it since. So we were really left wondering what role her exposures to things in the environment and harmful chemicals might have played. And then, as you mentioned, I'm also an investigative journalist. And so I was still thinking about those questions when I wrote an investigative series about the role that air pollution and other environmental chemicals in Pennsylvania play in our disproportionately high rates of certain types of cancers, including thyroid cancer. My sister and I grew up in Pennsylvania. And while I was writing that series, I learned some things that were really shocking to me. First is that since we started tracking cancer rates in the 1970s, rates of childhood and early adult cancers have been steadily rising. And that's true in the United States, but also at the global level. And while I was writing that series, I talked to this really smart researcher who's a pediatrician and an epidemiologist named Dr. Phil Landrigan, who later ended up writing the foreword to my book. And he said, that change is too fast to be explained by genetics. So genetic changes take place over centuries, not over decades. And he also said, this isn't just a matter of diagnosing more of what's always been there because we have better diagnostic tools. So the only other option is something in the environment. And that includes things like, exposure to pollution and harmful chemicals, but also diet and exercise and smoking. But when we're thinking about kids, kids generally aren't smoking or drinking, damn, and they generally love exercise. And then he also said that over the past 100 years, we've invented 300,000 new chemicals that are brand new, novel materials never before seen on the planet, and only a tiny, tiny fraction of them have ever been tested for safety. And that even when we do find them to be harmful, they generally stay on the market, particularly in the United States. So in the last 50 years, the United States has only taken 5 chemicals off the market because they're found to be harmful.
Christina Morosik, our guest today, her book titled A New War on Cancer. Throughout the book, I thought it was interesting. You follow a woman named Barry Breen. And so what does her story illustrate about the wider theme of your book?
Barry is a young woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2020, kind of right at the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. And she grew up in a place called Oil City, which is near Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania. And it's considered the birthplace of the American oil industry. It's really close to where the United States' first oil well was discovered. And it was an oil hub for many years. Pennzoil was founded there, and Wolfshead and several other major oil companies. So she grew up kind of surrounded by refineries. She was not genetically predisposed to get breast cancer, and no one else in her family had had it. So she had a similar experience of being left wondering, why did this happen to me? And so her story, I think, serves as an example of what a lot of people go through when they get a cancer diagnosis, which is asking, why did this happen? Is there anything I could have done to prevent this? Is this because of where I grew up, or, that time I smoked cigarettes in college, or, people are left with a lot of questions when that happens to them.
And they tend to be asked, what did I do wrong?
That's right.
And as you point out, it's, a lot of times it's nothing they did wrong at all.
Yeah, I think a lot of our, I mentioned that only a very small 7-9% of cancer funding goes toward prevention. And the little that does is generally focused on these kind of individual lifestyle behaviors, right? Like not smoking and exercising and eating healthy. And those things are important and they're worth doing for lots of reasons, right? They're good for us beyond just lowering our cancer risk, but they're also not the only things influencing our cancer risk. And a lot of them are, that we're just kind of constantly exposed to these low doses of chemicals that raise our cancer risk throughout our daily lives. And I think we need to start asking questions about what we can do at a bigger picture, more systemic level to reduce those exposures so fewer people get cancer.
And what are some of the cancer-causing chemicals that we encounter in our daily lives?
So we encounter chemicals that raise our cancer risk in every part of our lives, unfortunately. In food, we are exposed to things like pesticides and PFAS, which are also referred to as forever chemicals, carcinogens like nitrates and nitrites. In drinking water across the country, we've seen PFAS and arsenic and things like hexavalent chromium. That's the chemical that was made famous by Aaron Brockovich that actually shows up in drinking water more often than you might expect today. In air pollution, there's things like benzene and diesel. And in the materials used to make the buildings we spend most of our time in, there's asbestos, heavy metals, formaldehyde. In our personal care products, so things like shampoo and lotion and makeup, there are lots of endocrine disrupting chemicals that can raise our cancer risk. And those are very poorly regulated in the United States in particular. And then in schools and daycares, kids are exposed to things like pesticides and phthalates in toys. And then in medical settings, even when we go to the hospital to get treated, we're exposed to things like endocrine disrupting chemicals in IV bags and tubing, and some of the sterilizers used in medical settings are toxic. So it's kind of everywhere, unfortunately.
It's pretty hard to avoid. Ivy in Evansville has a comment. Let's go there. Ivy, hi.
Hi, thanks. I have a comment about something we can control, which is the amount of pesticides we use for example, in lawn care. You know, I know people spray their lawns and their pets walk through that and they lick their feet and children play in the dirt. And their hand, you know, kids are always putting their hands in their mouths. And all of this is to get rid of, say, dandelions. They are invasive, but so is the grass that we plant on our lawns. I mean, I'm not opposed to pesticides used in integrated pest management. You know, if a farm is going to go under, you know, they might need to spray. But, for example, I know that dicamba is a pesticide that is used in soybeans because soybeans are now resistant to dicamba. And that pesticide also, it's not for lawn care, but it can spread a couple of miles if it's not applied correctly.
Christina, comment on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think one of the things I write about in the book is the need to educate parents and people who take care of small kids, like in daycares and early learning centers, about the some of the harms posed by pesticides. And work to, I profile a woman in the book who is working to implement programs at daycares and early learning centers across the country that reduce kids' exposure and ask them to use things like integrated pest management at those places to help reduce exposure. So I think you're absolutely right to be concerned about those.
NC Witherspoon, we'll talk more about her as we move along today. She is the person that was that you just referenced in the book. I was just absolutely amazed at the influence of PFAS. I mean, we've talked on this program a lot about PFAS, and especially as it relates to water. But I didn't know that it was in the popcorn bags, for example.
Yeah. One of the people I profiled in the book is Laurel Shader, and she's a researcher studying PFAS in food and drinking water. And her research found that PFAS is used in the coating on a lot of food packaging. You mentioned it's used on the inside of microwave popcorn bags to keep butter and grease from kind of seeping through the bag. But it's also used on that little piece of paper that comes underneath your pizza and the little brown piece of paper that you get your baked goods in from your local coffee shop. And even in those like brown biodegradable boxes that you get takeout or a salad bar in sometimes if they have a waxy coating inside that often uses PFAS. And she led the first study to show that these chemicals on food packaging are migrating into our bodies. She found that people who eat takeout regularly had significantly higher levels of PFAS inside their bodies than people who mostly cooked at home, which I agree, it's a little alarming.
It is indeed, and we'll talk some more about Laurel and some of the other folks, Ami Zora and NC Witherspoon. Are three of the people I wanted to highlight. I happen to be on an early learning center board of directors, so I was very interested in that particular chapter. And we're going to go in more depth with our guest today, Christina Maruzic. Her book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. And we'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then you can join in. Do it right now. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we're talking about the book, A New War on Cancer. The subtitle is The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. And the author's with us today, Christina Maruzic. She is a journalist who writes for Environmental Health News. She covers environmental health and justice. And it's great to have Christina with us today. I loved her book. What connections are you making between the health of our environment and cancer? What's at the top of your list of environmental health concerns? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Christina, Katie in Burlington called in, couldn't stay with us, but she said she attended a PFAS roundtable with experts from our DNR, or Department of Natural Resources, and one of the experts said you even find PFAS in toilet paper. And her question is, how do you avoid it, if at all?
It's really hard to avoid PFAS as an individual consumer. And one of the things I heard again and again while I was talking to experts while writing the book was that this problem is too big for us to shop our way out of. You know, I think we're often told that the way to protect our health and specifically to reduce our cancer risk is all through our choices, right? Reading labels and being really careful about what we buy and eating organic. Yeah. And with most of these chemicals, they're just too ubiquitous now. Even, you know, people who have PhDs in organic chemistry were telling me, you know, I know everything there is to know about this and I can't completely avoid exposing my kids and my family to these chemicals because they're everywhere. So we really need to pull together and push for better regulation of these chemicals that raise our cancer risk.
Yeah, and one of the people who's doing that is Dr. Laura Shader, who I think you were having a burrito with, if I remember, and even wondering about the potential for PFAS in the burritos.
That's right. Yeah, we had burritos together while we talked about, you know, what ingredients in this burrito might be raising our cancer risk and should we be worried about the wrappers, you know, that they came in. And I think as we're talking about more and more sources of these exposures, it can feel a little overwhelming and a little scary. But you mentioned that the book is hopeful, and that's one of the reasons the book is really focused on solutions. So the book is all about the people who have made it their lives' work to try and reduce our exposure to these chemicals and all the progress they've made and what the rest of us can do to help out their efforts.
And Dr. Laurel is doing some fantastic work in this area, and at the legislative level, that's where a lot of this has to happen. But as you point out in the book, it takes a long time sometimes to get, for example, lead out of gasoline, I think was the an example you used. And yet the benefits are there, as you point out, to society as a whole.
Yeah, these things often move slowly when we are talking about federal level legislation, but there are lots of examples of us doing this in our history. You mentioned lead and gasoline, and the Clean Air Act is another example. And we can really quantify, you know, the number of lives saved, and when it comes to lead, the number of IQ points gained in Americans. And
I think it was 4 to 5 IQ points we gained over 40 years by taking lead out of gasoline.
I think that's right. Yeah. So we know these things are doable and that they're worth doing. And then in the meantime, because that can feel kind of, you know, there are lots of ways we can all pitch in and try to help get to a place where we have better federal regulations. But there's also a lot happening at the state level right now when it comes to these issues. Colorado has passed really expensive bans on PFAS at the state level. And Washington state just recently passed really extensive legislation getting harmful and cancer-causing chemicals out of a lot of consumer products. So we have a lot of levers we can pull in terms of, you know, driving toward kind of systemic changes that would protect all of us.
Yeah. Nina in Menasha has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nina.
Hi. I want to just thank you, first of all, for both of you. I thank you for the show and book. If you could just say the name again, because I didn't catch it. But I would love to get the book. I can't wait. Thank you for all your hard work. Dr. Laura, is that it? Anyway, I called to make a comment of I have been a very stern and make my family, even my extended family, not wear outside shoes indoors. I mean, it. You cannot believe, think about it, gravity. Everything falls onto the ground. People spit. You know, it's you're walking in the grass with the chemicals and the pesticides. And I want to just say, too, all you people in the healthcare field, don't keep your work shoes at work. Don't wear them home. My ex sister-in-law was a nurse, ER nurse, and there's a lot of stuff. Everything falls on the floor, and she'd wear her sneakers that she worked in the hospital with all the bodily fluids and diseases.
Wear them home. Yeah, wear them home. Well, I don't know what to say to that, Christina, but except it's probably a good point.
Yeah, it's probably good advice. And I'm the same. I don't like sneakers in the house. And in some places, you know, that's the cultural norm. You would never wear shoes in someone's house in Japan or Taiwan. So I think it's a good practice.
And speaking of other countries, there are some other countries that are ahead of us when it comes to eliminating. We might just mention that.
Yeah, absolutely. So their chemical policy in the United States is weaker than it is in a lot of other countries right now. And the European Union isn't perfect, but they have several really comprehensive regulations aimed at protecting people from cancer-causing chemicals that the United States could emulate, particularly when it comes to chemicals and things like cosmetics and personal care products and in medical settings. And I write about those with a lot more detail in the book.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was surprised at the beauty products and so forth. You write about Ami Zora, I believe, who's done a lot of work in this area, that makeup and some perfumes and so forth contain cancer-causing agents, and this is particularly a problem for women of color.
That's right. Yeah, the researcher, her name is Ami Zota, Z-O-T-A, and her work focuses on racial disparities in exposure to harmful chemicals in cosmetics. And she has found, and relying on lots of other previous research, that has shown that personal care products that are typically marketed to people of color and Black women in particular, like hair relaxers and straighteners, tend to have more cancer-causing ingredients than products marketed to white women. And this results in kind of collectively higher levels of exposure to these chemicals among people of color in general, and certainly among Black women than their white counterparts.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing to me. Scott in Wausau, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Larry. Thank you. And thank you to your guest. I was just going to make a comment on how somebody tested some rainwater and found PFAS in the rainwater. And so that kind of makes it hard to avoid altogether once it gets back into our wells and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. Comment, Christina?
Yeah, there's been a couple of big statements that have come out from scientific researchers around the world looking at PFAS saying, we need to shut this off at the tap. There are scientists who look at this and who have found PFAS in things like rainwater in really remote parts of the planet even are really concerned about this and have come together in kind of numerous different forums to say, we should not be making new PFAS anymore. This stuff should be only used when it's absolutely necessary, and all other uses of this stuff we need to cut off, because these chemicals don't degrade. They stick around forever. They're really harmful. And right, like the caller said, we're finding them in rainwater. So we need some big action on PFAS if we're going to avoid them.
One sort of hopeful sign that you point out or comment on is that nearly every major chemical company is working on what they're calling green chemistry. Could you talk about that a little bit?
So most of the big chemical companies have realized that consumers are interested in healthier products. If you go even, you know, if you go to the store now, there's a bottle of Clorox, and then right next to it, there's a bottle of Clorox Greenworks, which is the same company, same brand, but a cleaning product that's free of all the harmful chemicals that's in the regular stuff. And some market research has shown that products that are marketed as, you know, less toxic, green, environmentally friendly, tend to do really, really well. And so we're seeing some market pressure that's pushing companies that have traditionally made, you know, some of the most toxic chemicals we encounter to find ways of making less toxic versions of those products, which is a good sign.
And I think your comment earlier, and you point this out in the book too, at the state level, if work can be done at the state level, it can have a big impact on this. I think you use California as an example of something that it was prohibiting that's may change. If a company can't produce it in California, they might as well try and change it for everybody.
That's right. California has some of the strictest chemical regulations in the country, and it's a lot more work for a company to make, you know, one set of lipstick that they sell everywhere else that contains toxic chemicals and then have to make a special one only for sale in California because they don't allow those chemicals or they don't want to comply with California's extensive labeling requirements for those chemicals. So a lot of times that kind of stands in for federal legislation because it's easier for companies to just take harmful chemicals out of their formula altogether than to try and, you know, have two different production lines.
I want to turn to NC Witherspoon, who is executive and another person you write about. And this is a really fascinating people, by the way, that you write about in the book, who are doing some really amazing stuff. NC is executive director of the Children's Environmental
Health Network.
Health, yes. Network. Talk about her and the work that's that she's been on too.
So I mentioned NSA briefly earlier. She is one of the people who's been involved in this nationwide certification program for daycares and early learning centers to reduce toxic exposures for kids. And so the way that program works is schools that want to get certified through the program, and then they can advertise that they're certified. It's called the Eco Healthy Childcare Program. Are given a big list of, I think it's 35 small steps they can take, and it's things like not using pesticides on the playground and putting up signs asking cars not to idle in areas where kids are hanging out, and, you know, buying less toxic paints and toys. And if those facilities comply with 30 out of 35 of things on the list, they get a certification that they are in, you know, a less toxic place for kids to go. They can advertise that. They've trained thousands of daycares across the country now, and they're working with states and with the federal government to try and make the program a more of a requirement. And then that organization and NSA do a lot of lobbying at the federal level. So they've done a ton of work related to pesticides, and particularly pesticides that we know are harmful for kids, trying to get them banned or more strictly regulated at the federal level.
Yeah, and that can be a long process. I know she talked about, or she told you about some legislation in Massachusetts that they thought they had all taken care of and sort of fell through in the end at the governor's desk.
That's right. Yeah, they had passed legislation banning a really toxic pesticide that had harmed kids in the state, and then in the end was vetoed by the governor, and they had to kind of start over from scratch. And she said, you know, most people have no idea how much work and effort and how many months and years of work go into getting even these state level bans passed. You know, oftentimes you just hear about it in the news once it passes, but advocates like her and families who were affected, people who lost children or who had children who were sickened by these chemicals, you know, put in a lot of work and they just kind of get back to it. You know, that veto happened and they were just like, all right, here we go. It's time to start again. We're going to get this done.
You know, and you I'm sure anyone would wonder, well, why in the heck, here's a chemical that's of hurting our children. Why wouldn't everybody be in favor of getting rid of it?
Yeah, and that's a tough question, right? That one, in that particular instance, I think there were some lobbyists for the chemical industry who got to, you know, the legislature, who'd seen all this testimony, all this really heart-wrenching testimony from these families who'd been impacted, passed the bill. And then the governor, who wasn't there for any of that, maybe only heard more loudly or yeah, with more funding involved from lobbyists. And that's the way it went.
Yeah. Another area you cover is sort of relating to buildings and structures in our homes. Bill Walsh, I think, from the Health Building Network.
The Healthy Building Network.
Healthy Building Network, yeah. And I was interested in that. Green building is, I mean, you think about what's in some of the materials that go into a house.
Yeah, and that's a tough one. You know, one of the things Bill and I talked about a lot was you have to have stuff in your roof that's going to make your roof stay put for 20 years, right? If there's a new hippy dippy, non-toxic roof, nobody wants to be the first one to try it if it's not going to stand up to the elements and do the things that a traditional roof needs to do. So there's a lot of resistance in that industry to kind of trying new things. But the Healthy Building Network has done really interesting work to make it easier for architects and contractors who want to use healthier building materials to know what's in the materials, first of all, because if you think about a roof tile, it doesn't come with an ingredient list like a bag of chips does, right? So it's hard to even know what's in building materials. And they've done a lot of great work to increase transparency in the industry and incentivize using healthier, cleaner building materials and make it easier to do that for people who want to.
So what's been the response to your book so far?
It's been exciting. I was actually invited to Washington, D.C., to speak to the EPA's Office of Children's Health Protection about childhood cancer risk and environmental exposures. And I think, you know, that really shows that we're at a moment where there's a lot of willingness to listen and learn about this, where there's interest in taking action. And I felt really encouraged by the times that I've spoken, you know, not only with regulators, but also with kind of regular folks who read the book and feel motivated to pitch in and help get that done afterwards.
And there are some things that we can do as individuals. And I mean, I think you have a long list, but what are, in our last minute or so, what are some things that people can just do on their own?
So filtering your air is a big one. Getting a HEPA filter to run indoors can be expensive, but there's a really easy DIY version where you can buy just the square HEPA filter part and fit it in a box fan. And that can really help with indoor air quality. If you Google HEPA filter box fan, the instructions come right up. And there are some really good resources online for looking for less toxic cleaning products and personal care products, makeup, shampoo, etc. I like the Environmental Working Group's Healthy Living app for some of those tips.
Yeah, because, I mean, you see the chemicals that I mean, are these going to hurt me? Are these going to help? Are there, what's the best kind of signage on products to look for?
That's tricky. So The Environmental Working Group does certify some products as being free of a long list of toxic chemicals, and they list those products online, and then some products will have like a little emblem that says EWG verified, and that means they've done their own third-party analysis and verified that a long list of chemicals aren't in there. So that's one easy way to look for that label. And otherwise, it's a little tricky because there's not a lot of regulation around what companies can claim is in their products.
So, yeah, so it's, for the moment, I think we have so many thousands of chemicals that are out there that we're, I think it's easy to lose hope, but the thing I like about your book is that there is hope and there are people who are doing great things.
Yeah, I found that when I was writing about this topic, you know, it felt really kind of overwhelming and upsetting and scary. But then when I heard these stories of people who are working to solve the problem, it made me feel a lot more hopeful and connected. And it made me want to get involved. And I hope that it does that for readers, too.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really enjoyed the book. And I hope a lot of people get to read it. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Christina Marusek, our guest today, the title of her book, A New War on Cancer, the subtitle, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. Great to have her with us today, and love to have her on again at some point down the road. Tomorrow, we have entomologist Phil Pelletieri back to talk about insects that are surviving and thriving in dry weather, and he'll have a outlook on the army worm outbreak. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.